Steve and I developed the survey together that this presentation is based on, but this is largely his presentation that he developed. And I'm afraid it won't be as eloquent as if Stephen was here giving it, but we will do our best to have a good discussion. So the outline of this presentation is to discuss some misconceptions about how technology can or can't be used to mine genetic resources, talk about our survey, and some thoughts. So misconception number one, product life cycles and innovation in the U.S. seed corn industry. This publication talk about the average life cycle of products in the maize industry. And if you look at this list on your right, which you probably can't read, every single one of these is a transgenic event. It's a stack. It's strictly devoted to biotechnology. Nowhere in this publication does it deal with innovation in application of germplasm itself. And we all know that product life cycle is not dependent solely on the transgenic events that are integrated into our germplasm. Misconception number two, DNA sequence data are information per se. This publication illustrated the difference in the homology between two very important inbreds, both of which have been sequenced. MO17 on the non-stiff stock side, B73 or stiff stock. They were founders of the U.S. industry, and they are now our lab critters, okay? So of these, 50% of the compared sequence is non-collinear. And if you look at the transposons, and the LTR inserts, only 27 are shared, 62 are allele specific. So, yes, this is interesting information, but how do you apply it? Same misconception, DNA sequence is information per se. We have lots of things with putative functions. These are all important. They're all going to enable us when taken in context. Misconception number three, this figure, and I'm sorry Stephen didn't have the URL on here, but this was taken from an article on tomato breeding methods. But the misconception is that using sequence information or a single mutation or a gene editing method or a 3D printer, you don't need to use to mine genetic resources. And basically, it illustrates the difference between a conventional breeding program. Do I have a pointer? Yes, I do. A genetic modification program and a genome editing where you fix a trait. And once genome editing enables us to do many genes, many loci simultaneously, that will be a very powerful tool. So I'm going to skip the next two slides. They take too much time to just list the questions, and we'll just go directly into the questions and the responses. Is there a concern that elite germplasm pools may be getting narrow during the next and limit progress in breeding in maize in the next 20, 30 years? Well, the answer is yes. Everybody has this concern. Despite their desperate need for more pre-breeding programs, adapting, improving genetically diverse genotypes. Yes, absolutely, but relative to the narrow pools in the northern temperate zone, companies already have a lot of diversity available to them through their tropical breeding programs. This was an interesting comment. Expand the germplasm enhancement and maize program to other gene pools, not sufficient to cross with only industry-developed lines. So what the GEM program does, it takes tropical accessions or tropical inbreds, and either we cross them to XPVP lines or we allow industry partners to cross them to their lines, bring them back into the program, and distribute these, the breeding products, through the testing network. Another comment was, this one was more sarcastic. Really? That gene pool has been narrow for years. Okay. this person used the example of head scab that nearly eliminated barley production in the U.S. Good example, yes. This is a very thoughtful comment here. It's a really difficult question. The notion of providing resilience to pest epidemics is an obvious service of the germplasm system. The notion of maintaining sufficient diversity to maintain genetic gain is much more difficult. The difficulty is coming with a metric that captures diversity relative to expected long-term gain in light of the many quantitative genetic factors. We deal with a lot of complex multigenic traits. The last one, yes, I think so. Changing cultivation practices, climate change may force us to reshuffle some current germplasm to come up with new assemblies. It's like we need a new battery to be developed before we get the hybrid or the electric car to work. We certainly need brand new parts. That's kind of a clever analogy. This is still the same question. There's been concern that these pools are more limited since the yields of double crosses leveled off. Those were overcome by the use of single cross hybrids. The 70s southern corn leaf blight epidemic was overcome by removing T cytoplasm to produce hybrid seed. These were easy adjustments, they were easy corrections, they temporarily resolved the concerns of a narrow genetic base. However, they did not increase the diversity of the genetic base, which is absolutely correct. This one, excuse me. Persistent genetic variability continues to permit genetic advances within the narrow genetic base. Why is this? Is this because of continued more effective mining using markers, sequence data, haploids, improved data quality? Is it due to complex genetics of maize? Is there greater recombination in crosses, favorable mutations, controlling elements to maintain genetic variation that can be exploited by modern breeding technologies? So, you know, this has been a long time concern. Significant conservation and introduction efforts are lacking because of funding, and the limited attention span of the public, administrators, policymakers, politicians, etc. Germplasm enhancement requires long-term programs that are not affected by changes in support over time. The next question, does availability of off-PVP and off-patent inbred lines mean there's no need to source additional diversity? Basically, I'll summarize this slide and say no. They represent a more recent elite diversity. They represent only a fraction of the diversity of Zea. It would be unwise to dismiss the potential usefulness. They're clustered around well-known maize groups. Most people are working and wasting resources on these materials with the hope they will find better products than industry has found. There's really no chance of that, and there's limited diversity in these XPVPs anyway. If you recall Cinta Romay's article where she did the GBS sequencing of the Ames inbred collection, and you call the diagrams, all of the XPVPs are a circle this big, the maize inbreds are this big, the gem lines are kind of here, the exotic pools are kind of here, but the XPVP germplasm is only a fraction of the germplasm of the diversity of maize. This individual responded that this focus on PVPs, is producing a significant delay in the drive to access the larger pool of tropical germplasm diversity. That's an interesting comment. Do you see opportunities to advance yield from more effective use of genetic diversity in maize land races? And the answer is yes, as long as the development programs are funded on a global level, including developed countries. Disease tolerances, specific adaptation traits like flowering time, cold, and drought tolerance are traits of interest. It's critically important, and I think this is a very important comment, to draw on genetic diversity to expand corn into new areas. And with warming, with season lengthening, the Corn Belt is pushing north, both in North America and in Asia, We have areas of limited water, limited nutrient availability in Africa, other regions of the world. IPP and access issues hindering exchange cannot be ignored. These must be addressed at a global level. Harmonization would be helpful, but that isn't likely to happen in my lifetime. This last comment doesn't see much potential. However, a better understanding of gene function and utilizing improved gene editing tools will become more interesting as donors of non-GMO diversity for traits such as drought tolerance, NUE, and for alternate uses. Do you see opportunities to advance maize yields for making more effective and facilitated use of the diversity present in the wild relatives, which would be Teosinte and Tripsicum? Basically, no. Difficult to imagine how. Might be useful if there is no alternative in the cultivated gene pool. Additional studies might reveal how these variations may be used through gene editing or other biotechnological approaches. Making the jump all the way to wild relatives is very unlikely, except for some low volume specialty projects. You need a target. You're not going to go into wild germplasm without the target you're seeking. What information or work product do you need from a gene bank to allow you to make effective choices of accessions to source? This is a fairly familiar list. Availability of a representative set of viable germplasm, accurate and detailed passport data with agroecological data, characterization data for specific disease and adaptation traits, information across years, and high quality data for biotic and abiotic stress resistance, marker data and association studies, relevant core collections based on SNP diversity, agroecological data. You can create cores on as many criteria as you can imagine. High density or marker or sequence data in combination with basic phenotypic data. What evaluations, characterizations allow you to make more effective choices of accessions to source? Pre-breeding to eliminate photoperiod QTLs in subtropical and tropical material. So, maturity, husk cover, lack of ability to withstand high plant density, roots and stalk lodging, those are the obstacles that inhibit the success of our pre-breeding programs with tropical materials in the temperate zone. In addition, understanding the heterotic pattern, male and female pools, and the traits important for seed production. One of the things that has happened in the maize industry on the stiff stalk side is we've diverted all the energy from tassels to yield. And as a result, if you want to use these female seed parents as males and isos, they're problematic. One of the things that's been suggested to us as an objective for our next five-year plan in GEM is simply to improve tassels, male productivity of stiff stalk germplasm, which is something I wouldn't have thought I would have ever heard 15 years ago. The power to predict how land races perform in the Corn Belt would require extensive work to establish predictive power, but it's possible. That's the tip of a very deep discussion. It's a very interesting comment. Agronomic characterization, quality, in addition to roots, stalks, solar radiation use efficiency, photosynthetic efficiency. These are something we haven't traditionally characterized. DNA sequence SNP data, marker data allowing genotype-based associations, including heterotic pools. Do we have markers for heterotic association? No. Maybe someone does. I don't think we do in the public sector. Diversity in genome regions. other than known regions harboring major adaptation genes would be interesting. And lastly, having a universal SNP sequence data language would allow breeders to perform and report similar analyses and build more comprehensive databases. I'll check my notes here. Giving someone else's presentation is always interesting. These were some examples of characterization successes. Bill Brown, the Pioneer Prolific Composite, Major Goodman's Elite Line Crosses, Hallauer's direct selection within tropical populations. These were projects that all successfully adapted tropical material. So recycling and inbreeding are absolutely essential to increase the frequency of favorable alleles. And recycling constitutes the continued crossing evaluation selection in either pedigree selection, an example given here is Raymond Baker's development of iodine, or genetically broad-based populations such as stiff cell synthetic. It was not by accident that Jenkins, Wallace, and Baker included these founder landrace populations in the original breeding nurseries, because these varieties were consistently the top varieties in the Iowa yield trials back in the 19-teens and 1920s. So another suggestion here is marker and phenotypic, molecular and phenotypic data. We know that genetic load within exotic sources are much greater than those with open pollinated variety landraces. These were already improved materials. Does this ability to acquire molecular and sequence data and to identify these trait associations make exotic diversity more accessible? The answer is yes and no. Okay. They don't think that is a gene bank function. Need to tackle adaptation first before anything else. These genetic trait associations are costly to provide good information. If they could be leveraged to provide good predictions on phenotype, then anything in the collection that does not have field data could be useful, but it would be a very expensive endeavor. And they suggest that identification of lines carrying these desired alleles is best undertaken by the research community. The GWAS approach is useful, but it remains challenging, and probably not for maize accessions that are unadapted due to photoperiod sensitivity. And of course, SNP data would provide greater information for specific traits of interest within the course. So now we get to the question of gene editing. Do these techniques to create diversity at specific loci mean that the genetic diversity held in gene banks is more, the same, or less useful than it was 2 to 3 years ago? This question is prompted by a lot of noise out there right now, and I would connect this to Seth Murray's slide the other day, where he showed this peak of excitement in technology, then he described the trough of disillusionment, and then the stability as technology matures. So there's some noise out there. People are excited about genome editing, and they're suggesting that we could decrease the holdings in the gene banks by some astronomical fold, because we'd have all the genes that we need, and we just have to edit with them, okay? So I think that's what prompted this question in this survey. So natural sequence variation in loci determining traits of interest could be valuable for gene editing projects. The technology is still new. It's hard to predict how it's going to change the practical value of gene banks. And the current focus of resources on these materials, will likely delay some of the gene mining work for gene bank materials in the near term, but actually increase the mining work longer term. And it's going to depend on how the regulatory issues associated with this technology sort out and how the understanding of gene function progresses. So we do need to figure out these gene trait correlations before creating new alleles. The gene networks are difficult, they're complex, and the transformation bottleneck is always there, even if it's easier for private companies. And the last comment was natural diversity is always critical to be available. So the respondents were asked just to offer additional thoughts or comments. Daily conversion program should be undertaken for maize, as was done with sorghum. We don't have an MA analog in maize. We would love it if we did. If you can, I'm not sure where this comment comes from. I think it's kind of out of context with the direction of this presentation, but it deals with, or if you cannot comply with the Nagoya Protocol, Convention on Biological Diversity Laws, you don't have the license to sell to growers. I could not speak to that. The need to support gene banks to ensure that their operations are keeping quality germplasm cannot be overemphasized. The appropriations for the national germplasm system are vulnerable and likely insufficient. The Global Crop Trust is engaged in building a healthy endowment to support genetic resource conservation and meritorious national gene banks. They're doing a very good job of that. Long-term improvement programs on genetically diverse germplasm should be a first priority, with development of new gene pools a second priority. And they criticize the focus on the resources on giant programs like NAM and G2F that still use very small samples representing relatively few unique alleles. Programs like GEM should be expanded and extended to include international centers, gene banks preserve vitality, they're utilitarian, and they're a unique, important component of the cultural heritage of mankind. So we get to the summaries. Are we losing diversity in LEAP programs? Yes, but we need metrics. The challenges for adaptation. Can off-PVP lines provide necessary diversity, not to the U.S. breeding base as a whole? Could maize landrace diversity be useful to diversify the U.S. corn plasm base? Overwhelming answer was yes. Could the wild relatives provide useful diversity? Last resort, specific unique diversity needs sequence phenotypic data. What is needed from gene banks? Access to viable seed, passport info, basic agronomic data, appropriate market sequence data, relevant core collections. How am I doing on time, John Ming? Okay. It lists the evaluation data needed, the ability to find marker trait associations. Yes, that's taken by researchers beyond the scope and resources of our gene banks. And do the gene editing methods change the utility of conserving exotic germplasm? Well, they likely increase the utility. Additional thoughts, the daylink conversion, increased efforts on adaptation, recycling, global intellectual property protection, access, benefit sharing environments that encourage access, adaptation, evaluation, and use, and the fact that the gene banks conserve an important component. I'm not going to address this slide. These lines represent year of release and population density. And basically, the take-home message on this slide is that with improvement, we have increased the ability of maize to yield at high density. This is taken from Mark Mickle's Crop Science article. This table is kind of important. It shows the progenitor contribution to 305 proprietary corn inbred lines with known pedigrees. You can find them in the PVP certificates, registered in the U.S. from 2004 to 2008. And these lines highlighted in yellow are those with the largest genetic contribution and the largest number of descendants. And it's divided into within Monsanto, within Pioneer, DuPont Pioneer, and within Syngenta. And if you look at these lines and these numbers, you have a very few founders contributing to the majority of the diversity used in commercial names. If you look at these Monsanto lines, and they have different indicators, because if you remember, we started with Asgro, which was purchased by DeKalb, which was purchased by Monsanto, so all these lines are grouped under Monsanto, and many of them trace back were extracted from Pioneer hybrids, a further example of the narrowness of the base. Concluding thoughts. Breeders need to very carefully consider how they allocate resources to traits controlled by specific genes compared to the resources spent on broadening the genetic base and selecting for multigenic traits such as drought and yield. It's that latter category, the resources spent on broadening the genetic base, that has provided all the potential gain during the entire era of hybrid corn agriculture in the U.S. It's possible to have 30% exotic alleles without a hugely significant yield drag compared to commercial hybrids. It takes work. Consequently, it would make sense that breeders rebuild and re-equip the germplasm pools to continue medium and long-term prospects of performance improvement for important agronomic traits that are primarily under multigenic control. And these genes are largely anonymous. They're probably regulatory. We don't know what we don't know, basically. And Stephen had a cute slide up here at the end. Many of these people you probably recognize. We could take a test, but with that, I'll turn it over for discussion. Repeat that, Marilyn.
Should we not read the breakdown of respondents?
It was about half and half public and private sector, and about 70% U.S. and 30% international. I'm sorry, I should have said that.
Thank you very much.